Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to Standard Deviations. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Rick Bookstaber, co-founder and head of risk at Fabric. Rick is also the author of two books, A Demon of Our Own Design and The End of Theory, the former which is credited with anticipating many of the events of the Great Financial Crisis. He has an incredible resume that includes time spent at Bridgewater, Morgan Stanley, and the University of California. And he's here today to discuss how to think about risk in this most uncertain time. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So let's start with a definition here. I work in behavioral finance, and I think it's useful to get away from sort of the academic definition of behavioral finance and give one that's a little more usable or sort of friendly. We have all these academic definitions of risk, you know, things like the volatility of an instrument or something like that, but I don't think that's all that useful for the average person. How do you think about risk or define risk in the most practical terms possible?
I think, you know, for individuals, the first thing you have to do is understand the time frame that risk matters for them. So the typical definition of risk, as you mentioned, is looking at the bouncing up and down of the market day to day, what might happen in the next week. For individuals, risk is really the risk that they will not be able to attain their goals. Now, the goals could be unreasonable, and then the risk is very high. But for an individual, the risk is longer in terms of time frame, and it's also multifaceted because one goal almost everybody has is security, to not be out on the street, so to speak. The risk there has a different weight to it and touches a different part of the distribution than, say, the risk I won't be able to get a second home. So for risk for an individual, it's really more complex, and it's not just the market, it's not just the portfolio, it's the portfolio in the context of their lifestyle and their goals and their risk aversion, obviously.
Does the way that folks like you and I talk about risk differ in sort of an overly academic way from how people on the street think about it? So, I'll use myself as an example. So I'm 42, better than average savings, better than average salary. If the market dropped 50% tomorrow and I was heavily in equities, that's not a permanent loss of capital if I'm diversified. That's probably not even going to materially mean that I can't reach my goals. And yet I think the average person would see that as really risky, and they'd feel really rotten about that. So, I mean, I love Graham and Buffett and the rest of them as much as the next person, and I do believe that true risk is permanent loss of capital. But I think that we professionals can get sort of overly academic about this in a way that doesn't reflect the way that real people experience risk at times. How do you think about that?
I don't think you have to say academic versus real. I think it's people versus institutions. Mm. So if you're a trader, risk for you is maybe what's going on intraday or day by day. If you're a hedge fund or portfolio manager, risk for you is what might happen over the next month or two, or maybe even a year. And risk for you is simply where your returns are. So the standard methods of just looking at, say, some notion of, you know, standard deviation or variability can make sense. The issue is that people in academics really don't look at risk for individuals. If you look at courses in risk management, it's all about what I just mentioned, risk of a portfolio. But for an individual, it's really, again, risk versus a goal. And that obviously is a function of your goals. It's a function of where you are, as you mentioned, in your life cycle. I'm much older than you are. So for me, if something bad happens, I don't have the luxury of waiting for things to return like you would. But to your point, people are not totally rational in a sense in thinking about what's going on to their portfolio, you know, understanding their goals. So if you're an individual and you see a 2000 or a 2008 occur, yeah, you're going to be panicked. Mm-hmm. And you might take action because you feel like the world's going to end and you can't really take that long-term perspective. That's actually, I think, a good reason for people to have a financial advisor who can have a little more of a objective sense of what's going on, say, look, the dust's going to settle. You can sit through this. But you know, as you know, we're more concerned about loss than potential gain. And we just in our reptilian brain, I think, have a hard time pulling ourselves away from the current to look towards the longer term.
Yeah, I agree with you that I think one of the biggest risks of all is that our perception of the risk around us, even though in reality it may not threaten that long-term goal, we perceive it as such, and it triggers a behavioral risk in us, which is, you know, making the wrong move at the wrong time, which then can, I think, bring about the very thing we were afraid of. So I was excited to have you on the show. I mean, there's always bad news that will always be with us. But I gotta say, we have a bumper crop of bad news lately. It feels like we've got inflation worries. We have worries about new COVID variants. We have the Russia-Ukraine situation. We have worries about Fed tightening, just to name a few, as we sit here on February 15th and have this conversation. So I'm curious, from your vantage point, which of sort of the commonly discussed risks, those and others right now, seem legitimate to you, and which do you think are overblown or maybe loom larger in people's minds than they ought to?
Well, one thing I could say is geopolitical risks tend not to actually be a big deal for the markets. They're not sustained in terms of the effect they have on the markets. So what we're seeing with Russia and Ukraine is, I don't know how people are perceiving it, but certainly for you or me, looking at, again, risk as we should look at it, it's not going to be a big deal. As you look at time frame and you look at risks, the most violent potential risk, I think, is in the overconcentration and leverage that we have in technology and what, broadly speaking, are called the FANG stocks, which have had a huge run-up. If you look back to 2000, which is a pretty good analog to what's going on right now, the market dropped around 45%, broad-based market, but the what's called the TMT stocks, technology, media, and telecom, dropped over 70%. Now, I'm not saying that's what would happen this time, but it just shows that those sorts of things can occur. But although that type of thing is really extreme, history suggests that typically it doesn't persist for a long time. Inflation, on the other hand, is kind of a slow burn that can lead to a longer term problem. It may not lead the market to drop as much, but it can be the starting point for recession. It can be, if it's secular, it can lead to interest rates rising over 1 year to the next, and a rise in rates can have an effect on people's portfolios that they may not totally realize. You know, we think of bonds as not being risky, but really a 10-year treasury bond can drop 10, 20, 30%. So I would say the biggest risk from a violent short-term nature is in the over-leveraged, highly concentrated world that's focused in technology. The longer term risk is from inflation. But for us as individuals, if we have 10, 20, 30 years in our horizon, the risk that's there and is obvious and is in front of us is climate change. Mm. But it moves forward so slowly that we may not totally appreciate it. And another risk of the same time frame is demographics. You know, we know what the workforce will look like in the US or in Japan or in China or Germany 20 and 30 years from now. But the implications of that are not very obvious right now, but matter if you're looking at retirement in 30 years. So, you know, now the key thing that I've mentioned, though, is the nice thing, if there is a nice thing, about risks that really matter, the material risks, is they're not subtle and they're not hidden. So it's not like there's something lurking out there that I have kind of a bead on that nobody else is thinking about. It's more that people aren't thinking. It's there to be seen, but they may not be focused on it.
So a few follow-on questions. Why is it? Because I've heard other places that geopolitical risks tend not to be as dramatically negative for the markets as we sometimes assume them to be. But you're hearing a lot of talk now about, you know, Ukraine controls a quarter of all wheat production. Russia and Ukraine are big energy producers. Given how sort of intertwined the global economy is, why is it that global shakeups, global political shakeups and wars are not more catastrophic than they are to the market?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think part of it is that it's in the self-interest of any country and anybody who's attacking a country to maintain the country's structure and economy and production. So take a case where one country successfully invades another. They don't lay waste to the whole country. The production still occurs. And of course, there's substitutability. We are interconnected, but I don't think any one country can cripple the world were it to be shut down by war. Probably we could pose some scenario where that could occur, but that tends to be the case. So if you go back, I mean, it's really interesting, to different wars, to different major geopolitical events, really they end up being hiccups. And I think that's the reason why. But to us, you know, they're in the front of the news. They're, you know, major, you know, you're watching tanks go over the border. So they're very dramatic. And so I think that may be the reason we weight them as highly as we do.
Yeah, that makes sense, that psychologically, sort of visually, from what psychologists call a salience perspective, it's very salient. You see 100,000 armed men amassed along a border, you see tanks and jets and missiles, it feels very heavy, right? It feels very catastrophic. Yeah. But I think you've given some reasons to hope even in the face of that. Now, as a follow-on, as you've said, none of these risks are hidden from view. We're hearing about them every day. But I think you did a nice job of laying out two of the biggest risks for the market. One would be the heavy concentration and perceived overvaluation in tech stocks, and the other would be inflation. Now, if you think about these things, they in some ways they feel like they sit at odds with one another. Because if I look at the reality of 7.5% inflation and the wealth destroying effects of inflation, I go, well, it's time to get long some equities. I need to be, you know, I need to be taking some risk. It's the absolute only way I can have my wealth not be destroyed at a pretty remarkable clip. But then if you look at things like the much discussed CAPE ratio and other things, the market cap to GDP, all these things that value investors look at that are stretched by historical standards, you can also see how taking on excessive risk right now could potentially be bad if there's sort of a re-rating or where we begin to look at these things through new eyes. How do you think about a world where you have to take risk to keep up with inflation, but where asset prices seem stretched by some measures?
Yeah, equities tend to be thought of as a good hedge against inflation. I'd say some equities more than others. If you're a price taker, it's not so good. If you can dictate prices, you're fine. So I'd rather be Walmart than the people who are producing the shovels that Walmart sells. Also, if you make your money through intellectual property, then you're in better shape than if you're pure brick and mortar and have to rely on commodities and labor. So it's not just that equities are better. Some equities are better than others. Some will be hurt by inflation. Clearly, bonds are, you know, a major casualty if inflation occurs. But I think there's two things. We only have one case to look back on for inflation, and that's the 1970s and early 1980s. And the period from 1968 to 1982 was a period of nothing happening in the equity markets. In other words, it did go down and went back up. It went down and went back up again. But if you're in 1982 looking at your portfolio, it was at the same place it was in 1968. So clearly equities didn't do a lot for you during that period. And the period from around 74 on to about 82 or 83 was a high inflation period. Now, you know, that's one observation, and we had stagflation along with that. And a lot of the inflation was clearly directed at a critical commodity at the time, a critical commodity, oil. So based on that, you might say, okay, equities will not be as great a driver of or hedge against inflation. There's another problem, a really big problem with equities right now, which is the linkage of what's going on in the equity market with valuations. By most any standard, valuations, you know, price earnings, price to sales, are really totally out of line with history. In fact, they're either at or near their all-time high. If we have inflation and through inflation nominal rates rise, that's got to have a negative effect on earnings, because we now would be discounting more highly the earnings that might occur 10, 20 years from now. And so you can't justify the same PE ratio when the earnings are getting discounted at a higher rate. So given the high PE ratio, a rise in inflation, which gives a rise to nominal rates, is going to be really adverse to the equity market and maybe the trigger that starts to get the readjustment in valuations. And by most standards, price to earnings ratio should be about half of what they are right now for a substantial part of the market cap of the S&P.
Yeah, so I consider myself a value investor, really love tuning into the likes of James Montier, Jeremy Grantham, who recently talked about there being sort of a super bubble in three different parts of the economy, everything from commodities to U.S. equities to real estate. But when I look at my enthusiasm for sort of fundamental value-based investing, I can't help but say that it's cost me a lot of money over the last decade, you know. And again, so I hear things like Jeremy Grantham is making the rounds currently, talking about this super bubble, and in a lot of ways, I'm very sympathetic to that argument, and I believe that, you know, valuations revert to the mean over time, and yet folks like Grantham, who are very smart and very accomplished, have also been banging this drum for a very long time. In the world of risk management, where there's sometimes an in of one, you know, where you talked about just a minute ago, an inflation regime and what could we expect from an elevated inflation regime with respect to U.S. equities, we're really looking at an in of one, and the economy is very different. I guess my question is, how can we know when to rely on these sort of traditional ways of thinking about risk and value? And when, if ever, do we sort of say, well, you know, maybe it's time to question these priors and think in a new way?
Yeah, I'm very much in the camp of Jeremy, and I kind of feel his pain in terms of, you know, having this view and having it just be wrong for such a long time. And this is sort of the bane of risk management. And so I would look at possibly what Jeremy is looking at and pose it in a different way that may be partly a cop-out, but also I think is more correct if you're in risk management as opposed to portfolio management. There's two things going on, two components of risk that kind of have to combine to create the combustible mixture that leads to a market drop. One thing is vulnerability in the market, and the other is a trigger, an event that makes that vulnerability matter. So the vulnerability is kind of like how thick the ice is on the lake. And the event is a boulder that rolls down into the lake. So from a risk standpoint, I can say the market is in a high risk state right now. You know, I mentioned some of this before, high leverage margin is very high. People are out over their skis in terms of their investment in equities relative to their overall liquid investments. Concentration is very high. 25% of the S&P 500 capitalization is in just 10 stocks, and it's double that for the NASDAQ. Liquidity may not be as high as people think because the Fed may not be willing to step up to the plate like it did in 2020. So all these things, valuations being so high. So I think we can clearly say that risk is high. Now, that doesn't mean that there's going to be a bubble bursting, because the next thing you have to have is an event that kind of triggers that. So I can say that we have high risk, that we're in a position to need to be careful, without saying we're in a bubble and that bubble will burst and the market will drop 50%. So that's where the difference is. And we can stay in a high risk state, and I can assert it correctly year after year after year, even though the market goes up and up and up. And so I wouldn't argue sell what you're, you know, sell, the market's going to drop. But I would argue, realize that when you have equities, that the distribution has a bigger tail to it than it typically would. You know, and this is the nature of looking at risk management. If you're a portfolio manager and you're wrong 55% of the time, you're not going to survive. If you're a risk manager, you typically are going to be wrong 90% of the time, because you're talking about risks that a risk is something that typically occurs 5% of the time or less. So I can agree with the nature of the markets in terms of how Jeremy Grantham sees them, but not feel like I'm, you know, sort of behind the eight ball when things keep on going up.
So I think you and I view the world very similarly from an investment perspective. I've written about sort of potential energy versus realized energy, yeah, catalyst, right? You know, you think about a marble positioned at the top of a ramp, you know, that's a lot of potential energy, but it takes some sort of catalyst for it to, yeah, actualize that energy. And so what's fascinating to me, though, and if I may just play devil's advocate here for a minute, all of these same conditions were met in March of 2020 when COVID hit, right? Like we had high valuations by historical standards. We had deep concentration. We had all of these same, at least in the equity market, and perhaps not in housing, but all of these same sort of high risk conditions were met. And yet it was this just enormously short-lived dip. And, you know, I ask myself, is it possible that we live in an era now of intervention that's such that central banks and governments just won't let things play out, you know, the way they might otherwise? What do you think of that idea, that even though we may be living in this sort of high-risk world, that if the marble does get pushed down the ramp, that, you know, someone's going to stick their hand and catch the marble before it goes all the, yeah, way to the bottom, if I can just murder that metaphor a bit more.
Yeah. Well, I actually like that metaphor. I think that's a good way to think of it. The vulnerability in the market can be thought of as an increase in the potential energy, the spring tightening more and more. So if something happens, yeah, I think you can take that analogy a long way. March of 2020 was a singular event. You know, what the Federal Reserve did then was aggressive and courageous and saved the market from really a disaster. To give, you know, a couple of examples, I've argued for a long time, and it turns out correctly, that some ETFs on illiquid instruments like high yield bonds, emerging markets, are a chimera. Really, they give the sense of intraday liquidity, but you can't actually have intraday liquidity when the underlying instrument sort of trades by appointment. And if liquidity drops and people all try to sell with a sense that this is intraday, you get a dislocation and the ETFs fail. There's a dislocation and basically you get problems in that market. So we had a big problem with ETFs. We had a much bigger problem with treasuries, and ETFs are fun and interesting. Treasuries are the lifeblood of the market. If treasuries have a problem, the market seizes up and that's the end of the game. There was one day in March where treasury bonds, which are the most liquid market in the world, only traded $250 million. Basically, that market was shut down. So we were in probably the most dire position we've been in post-depression, worse than what happened during the great financial crisis in 2008. And the Fed acted really so quickly and so aggressively that they, and with many facilities that they never even dreamed of doing before. They never would have defended corporate bonds or ETFs. That was totally outside of their purview. And so we haven't seen things written about this, but you know, this took a lot of courage because they're doing things that normally they wouldn't do. They're doing it with huge amounts of funding. So, okay, that was March 2020. I just don't see that happening again. I don't see the Fed doing that sort of thing when it's a normal bursting of a bubble, a normal credit cycle or recession. I don't think they can. They actually don't have the authority to. They may not have the bullets left in the chamber to do it. And it's just not their job to deal with the ups and downs of the market. So I really wouldn't push what happened in 2020 very far. And even if you think maybe they would do it, you know, maybe isn't a very good basis for changing your decisions in terms of risk. So I would put the maybe at like close to zero. I don't think that the argument is a good one to say that we're in a new realm and based on what they did in 2020, they're going to catch the marbles, as they roll down the hill, down the road, you know, in the future.
Sure. So a singular pandemic called for a singular response that you wouldn't see perhaps in the face of a more typical repricing of the market and not part of the Fed's mandate.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, Rick, one thing that I struggle with, this is, I guess, a behavioral question, is you've already alluded to it in our conversation, that bad news, you know, thoughts of risk are stickier in our minds than optimism, than good news. We know that, you know, bad news is about 2.5 times as sticky as good news. And so I think when we go about our lives and trying to manage risk, thinking about things that could go wrong, thinking about how to manage risk, it seems weighty, it seems important, it seems real, it seems dramatic. And yet we know that over time, investing is really a vote for the arc of the human family bending in a good direction. You know, in long-term investing is really a vote on sort of the path of human progress going up and to the right. So how do we balance being a good risk manager in the moment with this reality that if you look at something like the 20th century, I mean, it's a horrible 100 years. I mean, multiple world wars, many other wars, pandemics, all these things. And yet over that time, we had very nice returns. And so, like you said, the human family tends to be resilient in the face of some pretty horrible stuff. So how can we be good risk managers when we have this asymmetry in the way that we weight pessimism versus optimism?
Well, that's why risk management is different for individuals than for institutions. You have to start with the idea, as you said, that long-term equities move in a pretty constant way. I think an interesting thing for somebody to do is go to Yahoo Finance, put the scale into log terms, and look at returns from, say, the 1930s on. It's a straight line. I mean, it's virtually a straight line. And you can go from the from the 1800s to now, and it's virtually a straight line with a couple blips on the way, obviously, from the Depression and so on. So you need to have risk management in with the perspective of some of those realities in the face of the fact that we, you know, have this concern about, it's kind of innate in us. You know, when we were hunter-gatherers, if something was good, it was we found some berries. If something was bad, it was a tiger was attacking us. So, you know, so it's natural. And different parts of our brain actually light up for good things versus bad things. So we have to say, okay, that's our nature. But the markets are not the nature of berries versus tigers. And so somehow or other, we need to have either guidance through an advisor or a strong risk management structure that we believe in enough to depend on it that keeps us from looking at the markets in the context of berries versus tigers. And I'd say that only up to a point, because really, even in our lives, the tiger part, the risk of failing to maintain a decent lifestyle, of, so to speak, ending up on the street, is a bigger weight and should be a bigger weight than do we get to keep our golf club membership or get a second home. So we could overdo it. We should have tools or people that can help us not overweight, unreasonably overweight the bad. But the fact is, we do have risk aversion for a reason.
Yeah, you know, I think your advice is sound, whether it's an advisor, coach, a system, tools, whatever it may be. I think if left to our own devices, we just tend to see risk everywhere. And those short-term, you know, the short-term tigers tend to be everywhere. And we tend to make a series of short-term decisions that sort of can thwart our long-term success. So I think it's almost like we need to externalize the project of risk management, whether it be to another person or to a system or an algorithm or wherever it may be. You know, you recently wrote a piece titled Rehearsing Future Risk Scenarios that I really liked. And it has a lot to do with my work, because a lot of my work is around helping advisors have better conversations with their clients. And in this, as the title would suggest, you sort of introduce this idea of encouraging financial advisors to sort of inoculate their clients against bad behavior by talking to them about what the future might hold and sort of exploring different scenarios. So I love this idea. I'm all about it. But it occurs to me that there's also a fine line because, you know, on the one hand, we want to educate them in a powerful enough way that this sort of sticks and that they take action on it and they don't forget it, which is no small task. We know that we forget most of what we're taught, but we don't want it to be so dramatic that we sort of scare them out. So how do you think about this process of inoculation, having conversations with clients that are salient enough to be powerful, but not so fear-inducing that they lead folks to make bad decisions?
Well, because the markets long-term go up, and because most really bad events, if you've got 10, 20, 30 years left, can be looked at kind of as noise, it should be happy news that, you know, if somebody goes through this with you, you say, oh, thank God, you know, it's actually not as bad as I might have thought. The basic idea when I talk about this is something that I thought about when I heard an interview with a soldier, and I can't remember the issues, but he was in a major battle. And when people said, you know, what was it like? You know, your bullets flying. So I said, it wasn't that big a deal. It was just like training. You know, and so you look at these guys like these Navy SEALs who are, you know, have all these things going on during training. It's stressful, but they know it's controlled. But once they're in an actual battle, it's like nothing new. So this is kind of the idea. If you're an advisor, you're like the drill sergeant trying to get your recruit well-trained before the actual event. So when the actual event occurs, it's like, yeah, you know, I know this story. I've seen this before. I understand how to deal with it. So that's the idea of what you're calling, you know, sort of inoculating somebody. So what I would be doing right now, if I were an advisor, I'd be saying to client, look, here's the risk, like we were just talking about, that could occur. Inflation, here's what it might do. If there's a bubble bursting, and let me show you what this might have looked like a few other times it's occurred, the Nifty 50, TMT in 2000, so that a client says, now, when this happens, a lot of people are going to be feeling like they've got to get out of it. But keep in mind, here's how the markets work. Here's your time frame. And so once it occurs, you can sort of remind the person of what they were thinking about and listening to in more reasoned and placid times. And you know, rather than sort of being frightened about it, they now can say, yeah, I get it. Now, there's one thing that's really important in this, and I've thought of this many times when I've talked to people. Risk is not a number. Risk is really a narrative. It's really a story. And it's a story that unfolds with twists and turns along the way. So if you were talking to a client and trying to give him numbers, that's not going to do it. Mm-hmm. That's theory. You have to talk through the process and the way the story might unfold. And as it unfolds in reality, you know, it's kind of like driving on a winding road and you can only see as far as the headlights can go. So you have to approach risk in more of a qualitative human way, as opposed to think that if you produce a bunch of numbers from a computer, that's going to do the trick. Mm.
Yeah, hard agree there that risk is not a number, that it is a narrative. And you know, this, what you're talking about, what we'll call this inoculation, it leans on a lot of great behavioral things like familiarity, pre-commitment, sort of helping people pre-experience this. I think one of the biggest things we're up against as advisors and as a community is that investors often have the memory of a goldfish and they expect that whatever has happened recently is what will sort of persist indefinitely. And things have been so good for so long with the, you know, with the noted exception of early 2020. I think, you know, recent research shows that investors are expecting about 17% annualized over the next decade. And I mean, you know, we'll see, but historically that seems out of line with what you expect.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for you to be successful when your investors' expectations are so misaligned with the likely reality. And so I think this is an important thing to tell them stories and prepare them for sort of the most likely eventuality so that they can make good decisions, be that soldier when the time comes that's trained for this day.
Well, that's, you know, again, that's why looking at the long-term path is helpful. But that's also why everybody, or a lot of people, are momentum investors. Mm. And the very fact that they're momentum investors is what leads to a lot of these problems. You know, risk management isn't immune from this. In fact, one of the big failings of risk management is most people measure risk by looking at what's happened over the last couple of years. They take the variability of returns literally. They take returns over the last 1 or 2 years, calculate the standard deviation, and use that as the basis of forward-looking risk. Mm-hmm. And so you're always looking through the rearview mirror, and I find it kind of interesting that everybody knows the mantra of past performance is not necessarily indicative of future returns. Nobody says past risk is not necessarily indicative of future risk. Mm-hmm. But that's the reality. The market's more vulnerable now than it was certainly 3 or 4 years ago. And so the issue of kind of being a momentum trader and thinking everything's going to go the same way forward not only applies to performance, but also to risk. And it's wrong, you know, on both counts.
So Rick, as we begin to close up, so my educational background is as a clinical psychologist. You know, I've spent my life in finance, but I did train to be a clinical psychologist. And one of my observations when I was doing that therapeutic work is that a lot of people's unhappiness was from trying to play it too safe. Like they would sort of try and live in the middle. Like, I don't want to get my heart broken, so I'm not going to put myself out there, and I don't want to risk it. And so I'm going to sit at home on Friday night, and then I'm going to be sad because I am alone. You know, a lot of times people sort of actualize the thing that they were scared of by not taking appropriate risk. So, you know, as concretely as you can, I'd love for you to think about one thing in people's personal lives and one thing in people's portfolios that they could do to improve the way that they think about or manage or approach risk for better outcomes, both with money and with life.
So personal lives, I think the one thing to do is to bucket your risk into different parts. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. One bucket is security. And if you know that you have enough in the security bucket that you're not going to end up on the street, then that's taken care of. And now you can look at another risk where you're willing to take a little more risk, and that might be for your day-to-day lifestyle. You know, if I can't eat out quite as much, fine, whatever. Then you have another risk where you're willing to take more risk still, which is for your sort of hopes and dreams and aspirations. Because if you can't get the second home, okay, you know, you made the wrong bets in the market, didn't work out, it's not going to kill you. So you kind of have your bases covered. And then you can, when you realize it in that form, you say, okay, my bases are covered. Now in this bucket, I can take more risk. I'm willing to go into hedge fund. I'm willing to really overweight in Amazon and Apple. Okay, that's fine. In terms of the portfolio, risk 101 is diversify. And really, that there's no mystery to that. There's no, you know, hidden trap. The best thing to do is to diversify. And for the security level, you want to be super diversified and lower risk. For your aspirations, it doesn't matter as much. But people right now are not really typically diversified, even though they think they are. If you're in the S&P 500, you might think, hey, I'm diversified. I'm in the market. I've got 500 stocks. Well, no, if 25% of the market cap is in 10 names, you're not diversified. If 25 to 40% of the market is technology oriented, either because it's in that sector or technology is essential to what it's doing, you're not diversified. So a key first step is to realize that holding a portfolio right now, holding a portfolio that's market capitalization weighted, is not diversified. You're really biased towards a bet in technology. And one way or another, you want to move away from that. You want to be more equally weighted across sectors. And that is kind of the biggest part of advice I would give in terms of people looking at their portfolio. And one way to see this is to use what's called a factor-based approach, to look at risk factors, you know, your exposure to sectors, your exposure to countries, your exposure to style, and make sure that none of those are overloaded.
You know, it's been a few years where some really egregious and stupid investing behavior has been richly rewarded. And we don't know when the day of reckoning will be, but I think there will be a day of reckoning. Not some catastrophic day, but a day when fundamentals matter again, a day when diversification matters again, a day when good businesses and high quality companies matter again. And so I think your advice is sound. We won't always have these sort of highly speculative markets where you're sort of rewarded for any old risk you take. So I think it's a smart time to revisit your portfolio with an eye to, you know, many of the essentials that Rick has talked about today. Rick, you've been wonderful. Just in closing, if people want to learn more about Fabric, if they want to learn more about your books, you're an excellent follow on LinkedIn. I can personally attest you post really thought-provoking content on there. Where can people find you and learn more about your work?
So, you know, the two books that you mentioned early on, obviously you can just get it at a bookstore, Amazon, or whatever. The book, The End of Theory, is one that's a few years old and goes through the issues of the failures of economics in dealing with financial crisis and solutions that we have to overcome that. The other book you mentioned, A Demon of Our Own Design, came out in 2007. And really is not dated in the sense that it's kind of a little bit of my life on Wall Street, but looking at major crises that I was in the middle of. And those crises give us a lot of fuel to think about as we look forward to what might happen. So I think those are still good books. The End of Theory in particular is more timeless because it's talking about kind of the essence of economics. In terms of Fabric, our website is fabricrisk.com. If you go there, you can see different commentary and articles that I've written. I've tried to be very active in writing about risk from an advisor's perspective for two reasons. One is Fabric is focused on providing risk solutions and a risk platform for financial advisors, for the wealth management community. And secondly, I feel that the financial advisor and wealth management community has really been underserved in terms of risk. As we've talked about, most of risk management is focused on institutions. It's short term. It only looks at the portfolio and not the person. So I'm trying to give a more rich view of how to look at risk management from the perspective of an individual and therefore an advisor who's advising an individual. So, in the LinkedIn, as you mentioned, I write things there. But so the books, the Fabric website, and LinkedIn, I think, and through the website, things I've written, I think are all good sources.
So I'll tell a quick funny story. I get reached out to just about daily by PR folks asking people to be on my podcast. And I didn't know Rick, and his folks reached out to me, saying that he was going around doing the podcast circuit. And I would say, 9 times out of 10, I just say no. But I had actually quoted you. I had actually quoted you, not knowing you. I had actually quoted you in some of your work in a recent presentation. And so I said, oh, I know this name. His thinking has found its way into my own and shaped my own. So just as a second vote for Rick's work being great. And I'd be remiss if I didn't throw in a little word here as well. Rick talked about mental accounting and bucketing as one approach for thinking about risk. We at Orion are working on something we call Protect, Live, Dream. So bucketing into these sort of three buckets, helping use that as a way to help clients think about risk in a more goals-based way. There's a ton of great behavioral research that shows when you do that, folks make better decisions. So look for that this summer, Protect, Live, Dream from Orion. Rick, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom today. It's been awesome to speak with you. I've learned a lot, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.